I have to be honest this morning. I've been anticipating this morning since sometime this summer because we've set this whole series going through and I knew Joshua was coming and I may or may not be responsible for who gets assigned what. And Joshua is one of my favorite books, so guess where I assigned myself this morning. And I may or may not have made sure that I didn't preach what Troy preached last week, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So I'm kind of excited about this morning. And he did a great job. He really did such a great job with all that was going on there. But I'm super excited this morning. And I hope that you felt this as we've gone through this series, is that we're kind of sitting over the whole thing. And it's been such, the whole story of the Bible, it's been so refreshing for me. It honestly reminds me of going to seminary. Because my whole life, you will hear just a verse or a chapter preached, and you don't really have the whole context. But I remember in seminary, we slowed down and kind of looked at the whole thing at a time, and you got a bigger understanding of what God was doing in the Bible. And because of that, at no other time in the history of our church have we tried to give you more resources. So I don't know if you remember, but the first day of this series, you walked in and we gave you a Bible. And inside of that Bible was a bookmark. And we said, hey, if you'll just read this, we're not going to overwhelm you. We're not going to make you read 30 chapters a day for the next year of your life. But three times a week, if you'll read this, you're going to follow through this book called the Bible. And you're going to have an unbelievable understanding. But it wasn't just for adults. We've also tried to resource families and kids. We've showed you tripping through the Bible, where we go and there's kids things, and that's on the app that's also for sale out here. So we're trying to resource you. But one of the resources that we've used, maybe behind the scenes that you have not seen so much, is a thing called the Bible Project. The Bible Project is a series of videos where some incredibly smart people have used some incredibly creative ways to communicate all that's going on in one book or not. And so this morning, to kick off the book of Joshua, I'm actually going to show you this video. And I want to show it to you for two reasons. The first is it gives an unbelievable overview of the book of Joshua. But the second reason is this. I want you guys to realize we're not joking when we're asking you to give these resources. We didn't spend time and money just to, you know, flippantly do this. We're actually saying, do you realize that over the next 9 months, if you'll utilize the bookmarks, if you'll come to the sermons, if you'll look through the kids' stuff, and if you'll watch videos like these, you could literally have an understanding of the Bible that most Christians have never had access to. And we want you to see it. So, well, I want you to see this video. It's a little longer than maybe you thought. It's about 8 minutes, but I promise you're going to think it's about three because of how well it's done. But check out this video from the Bible Project over the book of Joshua.
The book of Joshua. Let's back up and remember the story so far. So God chose Abraham, and then his family became the people of Israel, who are then enslaved down in Egypt. And so through Moses, God rescued Israel out of Egypt. He made a covenant with them at Mount Sinai, and he brought them through the wilderness. So Israel then camped outside the promised land, and Moses called them to obey God's commands so that they could show all the other nations what God is like. The book of Joshua picks up right after Moses has died, and Israel's ready to enter the land. So the story of Joshua is designed with four main movements. Joshua first leads Israel into the promised land, and then once they're there, they meet all this hostility from the Canaanites, and so they engage them in battle. Then after their victories, Joshua divides up the promised land as the inheritance for the 12 tribes, and then the book concludes with these final speeches that Joshua gives to the people. So let's dive in and we'll see how all of it flows together. The first section begins with Moses' death, and Joshua is appointed as Israel's new leader. And the author intentionally presents Joshua as a new Moses. So like Moses, Joshua calls the people to obey the Torah, which means the covenant commands that they were given at Mount Sinai. And then Joshua sends spies into the land, just as Moses did back in Numbers chapters 13 and 14, except it goes way better this time. In fact, even some Canaanites turn and follow the God of Israel. Joshua then leads all Israel across the Jordan River and into the land. Just like the sea parted for Moses in the Exodus, so here the River Jordan parts and the priests carry the Ark of the Covenant across, leading all Israel with them. Now, in chapter 5, the story transitions. So the people look back to their roots as God's covenant people, and so the new generation is circumcised and they celebrate their first Passover in the land. But then they turn and prepare to go forward. And Joshua has this crazy encounter with a mysterious warrior, who, it turns out, is the angelic commander of God's army. And Joshua asks, "Are you for us or are you for our enemies?" And the warrior responds, "Neither." Which shows that the real question here is whether Joshua is on God's side. It makes clear that this whole story is not about Israel versus the Canaanites. Rather, this is God's battle, and Israel is going to play the role of spectators or sometimes supporters in God's plan, which leads to the next section. We find stories about all these conflicts that Israel had with different Canaanite groups. And the first part retells the story of two battles in detail, and that's followed by a series of short stories that condense years of battles into a few brief summaries. So the first two battles are against Jericho and then Ai, and they offer these contrasting portraits of God's faithfulness versus Israel's failure. At Jericho, Israel is to take a completely passive approach. So they let God's presence in the ark lead them around the city to music for 6 days. And just like Rahab turned to the God of Israel, maybe the people of Jericho would do the same, but they don't. And so on the 7th day, the priests blow the trumpets and the walls come falling down, leading Israel to victory. The point of the story is that God is the one who will deliver his people. Israel simply needs to trust and wait. Now, the next story of the battle at Ai makes the opposite point. So there's this Israelite named Achan, and he steals from Jericho some of the devoted goods that were to belong to God alone, and then he lies about it. It's a pretty lame move after all that God has done for Israel. And so Israel goes into battle with the city of Ai, and they're totally defeated. And it's only after humble repentance and severely dealing with Achan's sin that Israel gains victory. And so together, these two stories, they're placed right up front to make an important point. If Israel is going to inherit the land, they have to be obedient and trust in God's commands. They don't get special treatment. Now, the second part of this section begins with the Gibeonites, a Canaanite people group, and they do just what Rahab did as they turn to follow the God of Israel and they make peace with Israel. This is in contrast to all of these other Canaanite kings who start to form alliances and coalitions, and they want to destroy Israel. So Israel engages them in battle, and they win by a landslide. And so this whole section concludes with this summary list of all of these victories won by Moses and then by Joshua. Now, let's stop for a second, because odds are that these stories and the violence in them, they're going to bother you. And if you're a follower of Jesus, you're bound to wonder, like, didn't Jesus say to love your enemies? Why is God declaring war here? So first, why the Canaanites? The main reasons are actually given earlier in the biblical story. It's that the culture of the Canaanites had become extremely morally corrupt, especially when it comes to sex. Go check out Leviticus chapter 18. And they also widely practiced child sacrifice. Go see Deuteronomy chapter 12. And so God didn't want these practices to influence Israel. The Canaanites had to go. Which raises the second question. Did God actually command the destruction of all the Canaanites, like a genocide? So at first glance, you know, you look at the phrases used in these stories. They totally destroyed them. They left no survivor or anything that breathed. But when you look a second time, more closely, you'll see that these phrases are clearly hyperbole and not literal. So go back to the original command about the Canaanites in Deuteronomy chapter 7. Israel is first told to drive out the Canaanites, but then to totally destroy them, and then that's followed by commands to not intermarry with them or enter into business deals with them. So you can't marry someone that you've destroyed. I think you get the point. The same idea applies to the stories in Joshua. Look closely. So for example, we're told in Joshua chapter 10 that Israel left no survivors in the cities of Hebron or Debir. But then later in chapter 15, we see these towns and they're still populated by Canaanites. And so what we're seeing is that Joshua fits in with other ancient battle accounts by using non-literal hyperbolic language as part of the narrative style. And so the word genocide doesn't actually fit what we see here, especially in light of the stories about the Canaanites who did turn to the God of Israel, like Rahab or the Gibeonites. God was open to those who would turn to him. The last thing to think about is that these stories mark a unique moment in Israel's history. These battles were limited to the handful of people groups living in the land of Canaan. With all other nations, Israel was commanded by God to pursue peace. Go read Deuteronomy chapter 20. So the purpose of these battle stories was never to tell you, the reader, to go commit violence in God's name. Rather, they show God bringing his justice on human evil at a unique moment in history and how he delivered Israel from being annihilated by the Canaanites. Now, let's go back to the book's design. After years of battles, we see an aging Joshua, and he starts dividing up the land for the 12 tribes of Israel. And most of this section is like lists of boundary lines. And let's be honest, it's kind of boring. It's like reading a map that has no pictures. But for the Israelites, these lists were super important. This was the fulfillment of God's ancient promises to Abraham that his descendants would inherit the promised land. And so now it was all coming to pass right down to the detail, which leads to the final section. Joshua gives two speeches to the people that are very similar to the final speeches of Moses in Deuteronomy. Joshua reminds them of God's generosity, how he brought them into the land and rescued them from the Canaanites. And so he calls them to turn away from the Canaanite gods and be faithful to the covenant they made. If they do, it will lead to life and blessing in the land. But if they're unfaithful, Israel will call down on itself the same divine judgment that the Canaanites experienced. They'll be kicked off the land into exile. And so Joshua leaves Israel with a choice. What is Israel going to do? That's the big question that looms as the story ends, and that's the book of Joshua.
You guys have no clue how jealous I am that they can do that in 8 minutes and I can't even touch it in 35 minutes. Here's the reason. Again, you have no clue how hard it was for me to give up 8 minutes of my sermon time. But I want you guys to know this. Like, join thebibleproject.com, and over every book that we're going to read, there's one of these. And so it's super helpful for you to get a big picture of what's happening in the Bible. But here's the thing, it leaves this question, ask the question, what are they gonna do? What are the people of Israel gonna do? Their first choice is that they can be faithful, and if they're faithful, they're gonna inherit the land and everything's gonna go well. The way maybe we would say it from a New Testament time is that they're gonna have an abundant life. Or if they're unfaithful, that there's going to be divine justice and exile, and they're going to lose their land. Just total destruction will happen. And isn't it crazy? That's pretty much where we live our lives daily. What are we going to do with God? What choice are we going to make when it comes to God? And here's the nature of our decision, right? Is that most of you sitting in this room, you came to a point in your life where you made kind of a macro decision, and it was maybe, we call it salvation, where you said, yes, I am going to follow you, God. I'm going to choose you. I'm going to bow the knee to Christ, and I'm going to point the trajectory of my life to you. But then there's also, that's a big decision that we need to make. But there's also that daily decision of what does it look like to follow Jesus? What are you going to do with the temptations that you're going to face today? Are you going to choose God's way? Are you going to choose your own way? And today we're going to kind of look at two of those examples that they talked about in this book, with Jericho and Ai, and also with the speeches of Joseph at the end of the book. And so he did it. He showed you through what happened with Jericho. But here's what happens with Jericho. We're going to see this really play out well. Jericho, God gave them crystal clear instructions. Go around Jericho six times, or six different days. And on the seventh day, go around seven times and blow a trumpet and the walls will fall down. And what's crazy is these instructions for this battle plan are incredibly clear, but they're also kind of crazy. If you cross into a new country, you want a good military battle plan. And that's not what God gave them. God didn't give them a battle plan. He gave them a ceremony to do. Isn't that kind of crazy? God, we need to beat these people, and you're having us perform a ceremony? What? What's going on? And not only that, what's crazy even further is that he included all the warriors. The warriors were the ones to go around and walk. So maybe they're sitting there biting at the chomp, ready to get into battle, and they just have to walk. Warriors are made to war. They're not made to walk around and sing. I don't know about you, but I've never seen army people walk around and sing instead of fighting. But that's exactly what God does. And the people of Israel, they do it. The best I can tell, the best research that I could do, that there was this wall was around 6 to 9 acres, and they walked around it. And what did they do? They did exactly what God did. But in the midst of his instructions, God gave them a caveat. And we're in Joshua chapter 6. He gave them a caveat to his plans. And in verse 18 and 19, here's his caveat. But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver and gold and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. And he says, destroy it all. But these things, these are sacred. They're to go to God. So it happens. Joshua and his team, they go around and they absolutely defeat Jericho. In verse 27, it says this, so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. And so apparently a lesson we can learn is if you're a military general and you win by just singing around a city, you get fame, right? It's like that makes you scary in the land, and it's exactly what happens. And so they win. But in chapter 7, there's a big but here at the beginning of this phrase. 7:1 says this, but the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things for Achan. I know in the video he said Achan, and if you're reading the Hebrew, that's exactly what it would be, but I'm just going to go the way I grew up in southern Oklahoma. Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel. So they followed exactly what happened in Jericho, but in the midst of the battle, they take some of the devoted things. And Joshua's completely unaware of this. So they're kind of on a roll. So he's like, hey, 3,000 of you warriors, go up to Ai, and you guys take that land. Get after it. Go. We're on a roll. Let's get this thing taken care of. And when they get up there, Ai is a small village where they only sent a few men, and they get whipped. The Israelites, who should have absolutely dominated, get their tails handed to them, and they're running back. And Joshua's like, what is going on? And he actually goes to God and he complains. He's like, God, what's happening? Why did you bring us out here? Back into the same grumbling. Why did you bring us out here? What can I say? Israel's going to want to turn back. And you know what God does? He looks at Josh. He speaks up to Joshua and says, get up and consecrate the people. Don't complain. Don't cry about what's going on. You did this to yourself. Get up and go consecrate the people. Find who did this and clear the camp. And so Joshua does it. And he goes through and they bring all the tribes through. And in the tribe of Judah, we find that Achan is the guilty one. He confesses and he tells them, hey, it's all in my tent. Not only is it hidden in my tent, it's underneath my bed and it's buried down underneath the earth. And they go get it. And Achan, for this sin, Achan and his whole family are destroyed. They're destroyed. And then the people of Israel, now that the camp's consecrated and they're back doing things the way God said to do it, guess what? They march back up to Ai and have a glorious victory. And you see this, right? With Jericho, they were faithful. They took over the land. Everything was going right. With Ai and Achan, they were unfaithful. What happened? Destroyed. Not only were they beaten in battle, but Achan had to be destroyed as well. And here's where this tension that we see in the book of Joshua, that as a child of the promise, you have a choice. As a child of the promise, you have a choice, but you have to live with the consequences. He gives them a choice. You're my promised people. I've made this promise to you. I've brought you into the land, but you have a choice and you have to deal with the consequences. And we skip the overall story, but if we dig back into Achan, I think there's some real strong lessons for us here this morning. In Joshua 7, we're in 7:20 right now, we read this about Achan. Like, what drove him in the midst of seeing all these things that God did? What drove him to take the gold and the coat? And this is what Achan says when he's confronted. And Achan answered Joshua, truly, I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful cloak from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, then I coveted them and took them. And see, they are hidden in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath. This two verses show us exactly how Achan fell. In church, it should open our eyes to how easy it is for us to fall as well. Here's what happened, really simple. Achan's in the middle of battle, something's going on, and he's destroying a house. I have no clue what's happening, but you can imagine it. And all of a sudden, he walks into a house, and there's a cloak, and some silver, and some gold. And he saw it. He said, I saw it. And then he coveted it. He desired it. So the first thing that happened was he saw it, then he desired it, then he did it, and lastly, he hid it. And isn't that exactly how it happens in our life when we see sin? We see something, and maybe we don't bounce our eyes, maybe we don't, but we look a little too long, and then we start really desiring it in our souls. We're like, man, I really want that. Man, I really want that. And we jump and we do it. And as Christians, it's so natural for us to just start hiding our sin, hiding it. I didn't do that. Yesterday, my wife and I went to Sam's because we used to live in Waukee, and so we always went to Costco. And our membership with Costco is about up, and so we were asking the question, can we turn into Sam's people? Because we really like Costco. We shop there a lot. And so we were, hey, can we do that? And so we went to Sam's in Ankeny to see, hey, what's it like? Because we buy very specific things at Sam's. We have a list of things. At Costco, this is what we buy. And we wanted to go see if they have everything that we're used to buying there. And then what the prices were, so we wanted to do it. So on the way, I make a list of everything that we get. We get our eggs there. I love cashews, so we get our cashews there. We get protein bars. I mean, we have a list because who knows, if you walk into one of those places and don't have a list, you're in trouble, right? And so I'm making my list and we go in, but here's the thing. We're going to price and we're going to look at all those things because I've got my list, but we're in a new store and we don't know where everything's laid out and we've got to find it all and see the price. So I'm wandering around the store. I'm having a blast, and I'm just checking it all out. And so they let us go in the store to say, hey, we're going to check it out, see if we can move our membership here. And because we're just looking around, guys, I saw a lot of things I wanted. Right? I know in Costco, I know exactly where the eggs are at. I know exactly where the coffee is. I know where my protein bars are. I know where it's all at. But in Sam's, I was wondering. And here's a list of things that I was pretty convinced I needed. I needed a new TV bar, a sound bar for my TV, right? I was like, man, this would actually be, we've been redoing our basement. This would be a compliment to what we're doing. I actually saw some TVs, some like closed circuit TVs. And I'm like, we could use those at the church. That would be good to have security footage. I mean, so I'm checking them out. I'm flipping them up and looking at all the technology. The number of new food items that I wanted to buy was out of control. And it's at this moment, Carrie steps in and she said, Brent, how about we just get our membership today and I come back on Monday, right? Because our eyes are getting big because it's what happens in our lives. We see it, right? I saw the sound bar. You start desiring it. Then you do it. And then if you've sinned as a Christian, we run and we want to go hide it. We want to bury it. And Sam's is a really funny way to see that, but if you're honest in your life, if you could say, these are the three areas I struggle with sin, you would say, that's exactly what happens, Brent. That's exactly what happens. And can I give you a suggestion? Do you know the important thing not to do? You know how to kind of beat this? Don't linger. When you see something that is enticing to you, it's okay to buy food for your family, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But there's something wrong when all of a sudden you start seeing it and you start desiring it and you want to do it. Whatever that thing is for you, don't linger. If you see it and you know it's bad for you, run away. Your mama taught you this song. Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see. Don't keep your gaze on something that's going to destroy you. And then even if you do, break your eyes. Don't let it get into your heart because that's where desire comes from. And then don't let that what's in your heart come to your hands where you do it and then you go hide it, right? It's exactly. So how did this happen with Achan? Why in the world did he do it? That's the process. But I guarantee you, he justified it. He justified it in some way of like, yeah, we're moving into a new land and I don't have any gold. I don't have really any coats. We're moving into this new land. I need to make sure my family's covered. It's okay if I just grab a little bit. We're going to give most of it to God, but I'm just going to keep a little bit of it. He justified what he did. And his justification might have been okay, but do you know what the problem is? God said not to. And guys, same as Achan, we justify our sin like crazy. Like, I wouldn't be so angry if all the other drivers would drive sane. I wouldn't be a jerk at work if people weren't a jerk to me. I wouldn't look at porn, or I wouldn't sleep around if, God, you gave me a spouse, or if my spouse actually wanted to enjoy that with me. I wouldn't do that stuff, God. Or if, God, if you gave me enough money, then I would give the way you've asked me to give. But you've not given me a job that I can do that. And we're trying to just make it everything we can. And we justify just like Achan did. There's a problem. God has set a standard for us. Be careful, guys. Because you're going to face temptations all the time, but let me tell you the destruction of these things. Sin hides in the dark. Guys, he buried it for a reason. And you probably bury sin for the exact same reason. You don't want to get found out. Don't do it. It will destroy you. It will destroy you. Achan's unfaithful. He goes to destruction. And we see this thing coming again. As a child of the promise, you have a choice. You totally have a choice, but you have to live with the consequences. That's Jericho and Ai. The radical difference of what it means to follow God and follow his instructions and to justify and to get distracted and to do what you wanted to do. Then you flip over to the end of the book. Joshua comes and he brings this speech. And here's the reality is that Joshua's an old man at this point. He's a war hero. He's also the architect of splitting out all the land. And he comes to them with his final words. And he has been a good leader for the people of Israel. And so they're listening. And he kind of goes through and he says the exact same thing. Hey, if you follow me, if you do everything I say, it's going to be unbelievable. You are going to live in the land and be in abundance. But if you don't, it's going to be very bad for you. So you have a choice. Do you want to be faithful and live in abundance? Or do you want to be unfaithful and live in judgment with God? And there's this verse in chapter 23, verse 6. And it's like, well, what does it look like to not follow God? If he's saying, hey, here's your two paths, what does it really look like to not follow God? And this is verse 6. It says this in chapter 23. If you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them. He makes it very clear what it would mean not to follow God. And he says, if you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them. Do you want to put that in one word? The one word to wrap that whole sentence up would be the word idolatry. Are you going to bow down and worship the idols? And for them, it was super clear, guys, because they were going into the world of the Canaanites, and then the Canaanites, they truly had physical idols. And it was very odd, obvious, if you were bowing down and worshiping them, it was very clear. But for us, it's a little different. In America, there's not many places, I know you can find them, but there's not many places where actually are seeing physical idols where people are bowing down in worship. But John Calvin has this phrase that I think is so true that I think would be good for us to listen to this. He says that our hearts are idol factories. That our hearts, we're not going to bow down to real idols. That's not in our culture, but our hearts are idol factories. We are constantly making idols for us to battle, to worship. And so the question is, well, then, Brent, what truly is an idol? And I love this definition by Tim Keller. And he says this, that an idol is anything more important to you than God. An idol is anything that is more important to you than God. And if that's the definition, would you agree that we have a bunch of idolatry in our culture? There's lots of things in our culture that we value more than God. Material possessions. By nature of our suburbs, and I know there's poverty, real poverty in our community, but in general, Ankeny is a wealthy place, that our possessions, that we desire, we want things, and we don't even notice it, right? Exodus 20:17 is the commandment, and it says, you shall, it's about coveting, right? No, don't covet. Do you know what it says? You shall not covet your neighbor's home, your neighbor's house. Do you know how ridiculously unaware we are of the idolatry in our house? We actually have channels called HGTV, and all it does is make you covet your neighbor's house. Right? And you, every one of you, think Chip and Joanna are your best friends, and they're not. But listen, like, do you see that it's how close it is to our heart? That we want stuff and we want more of it. It's not just material possessions, it's our self-comfort. Guys, we want everything to be comfortable. We want no pain, we want no difficulties, we want everything to go right, and if it doesn't fit me and it doesn't make me happy at this moment, I'm not gonna do it. And we become our own idols, that our self and our comfort is more important. The way we look, our physical appearance, do you understand the trillion, I don't know if it's trillions, but billions of dollars that are made because your body image is an idol before you? Not only that, man, you want to talk about an idol in our country? Our government leaders. The nonsense of this election, it's crazy. I don't know very many Republicans or Democrats that are happy, so I can speak to all of you. But do you sense the angst? Because if we think if we get the right person, then the right thing will happen in our country. And we think if we get the right elected leader, everything will be perfect and our country will be great. No, no, no. The only hope for our country is God, right? It's an idol. Vote, you need to go vote. It is your right. But don't you dare put that as more important than God. When I was in college, I spent a summer in China, and I was in far western China, and we were among the Tibetan people. And we would go, and we spent a summer going to all these temples and praying and walking around these temples and begging God to bring a revival in that land, because there are very, very, very few believers. And a part of that process, there's idols everywhere. They're gods, they're Buddhist gods. And in that moment, you would see all these elderly and even young people all day long, starting in the morning at the sunrise, all the way to sunset, all day, not moving, literally wearing holes into the wood, bowing down before these idols. And it was the darkest place I've ever been in my life. And after a summer being there, God used it profoundly in my life. It's one of the reasons that my wife and I thought we were going to be missionaries for a long time. And I came home, and I had to get ready for college. And so a minute of getting ready for college, I had to get some new clothes. I don't remember what I was getting, but I had to go to the mall to get it. And I would only been back in the country for 2 or 3 days. But I was getting ready to go back to school, and I walked into the mall. And I literally was overcome and began weeping in the mall, because it was so obvious to see idolatry in Tibet. So easy. There's a real idol sitting up there that they're bowing to. But what's amazing about our culture is I saw people bowing down to idols. But this time, instead of bowing down, they were using their debit cards and their credit cards. Right? Guys, we are full of idolatry in our country, in our hearts. And please hear me, I'm not saying you can't go get clothes, right? That's totally fine. You need clothes in your life. But just hear this, that if those clothes are more important to you than God, you need to check your heart. If that whatever it is that you buy in the mall is more important to you than God, you need to check your heart. And he gives us a challenge. Joshua, at the very end of it, this is a very, very famous thing, and he says this in chapter 14, or verse 14 of chapter 24. Now, therefore, Fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your fathers served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me, we will serve the Lord. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Here's what Joshua's saying. Make a choice. Make a choice. You need to make a choice who you're going to serve. And here's the reality, guys. He's talking about, in this, when he's talking about kind of a macro decision. You need to decide where you're going to point your life. Where are you going to do it? Are you going to do it towards God or towards yourself? But he's also talking about those micro, everyday decisions. Who are you going to do it? Because it's a daily choice. It's a daily choice. You have to choose this day. You have to choose today who you're going to serve. It's almost like if you want to succeed in this, you've got to remind yourself daily, I'm choosing you today, God. And there's a warning for us. Guys, this happens in Christianity all the time. People want to celebrate when they chose God 10 years ago when they were in college and they went on a mission trip. Or you want to choose 10 years ago when you were really faithful to God, but now you've kind of slipped. It's not talking about yesterday. It's talking about today. Choose today whom you're going to serve. And I hope you've chosen the direction of your life, but I hope you'll choose it again tomorrow. And I hope again the day after that. And then he makes this point at the back end of this, that who you choose will impact others. And the very verse, last of that verse, it says, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Guys, I don't care if you're married, if you're single, if you're a grandma and grandpa, if you're very young, you have a household. You have people that you, the what you do and the choices you make, it affects others. If you're a husband and a wife and you have kids, that's certainly true. But even if you're single, there is a household God has put you around that you impact and that you influence. And he's saying, guys, if you blow it, it's going to affect your whole household. It affects Achan's whole household. And he's saying, choose today. Choose today. You know what the Israelites did? Immediately, this is what they always do. They'll go, we'll serve you, God. We're in. We would never disobey what you say. We're totally with you. Probably just like all of you are leaning in this morning. You're like, yeah, why would we do this idolatry stuff? They're full in. And listen to what Joshua tells them in verse 19. But Joshua said to the people, you are not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. Joshua knew. He had seen all that had happened with the Israelites, with Moses. They did the exact same thing with Moses. We'll obey now. We messed up, but now we're good. We're going to really do it. And then they would fall again. And Joshua's like, there's no way you can do it. Right? And guys, I don't want to be kind of a downer, but I'm telling you, sometime in the next day, week, month, you're going to do the same thing. No matter how resolved you are to, I want to follow you, God, you're going to make a mistake. You're going to blow it. But if I had to stop the sermon right there, and I believe that that's true, it would be kind of a really not powerful message, I think, right? You're going to blow it. Go ahead. Have a good day. But here's the good news, guys. This is where Jesus comes in. You're going to blow it. But God, knowing how much we're going to blow it, sent his son into the world and made a better promise for us, one that we could actually believe in, and that his sacrifice would take the punishment and the consequences of, or the punishment of all of our sin. And if we would only say, Jesus, we're going to blow it. I already have blown it. And if I'm given a chance tomorrow, I'll blow it again. So I'm putting all my faith and trust in you because you're the only one that can cover all my sin. That is our only hope. That's our only hope. You're going to blow it. You're going to mess up. But Jesus' sacrifice overcomes that. And every day we get to wake up in a right relationship with God, saying, Lord, today I choose you again. And if I blow it, your sin or your grace will overcome that, but I choose you. And we see this reality that as a child of the promise, you have a choice. Even under the promise of Jesus Christ, you still have a choice. What are you going to do? And the New Testament talks about this in Romans 6. It says, because the grace is so good, should we just keep on sinning so that grace will show itself anymore? And Paul shuts that down. He's like, no, don't do that. That's not what you want to do. But we want to honor Christ with our very lives. That's what we want to be about. We want to honor him. But Galatians 6 is one of my, I don't know why, but I always come back to this. Because even as a child of the promise, I have a choice. And while Jesus takes care of the penalty of my sin, I also sometimes have to deal with the circumstances of my sin. And this is what Galatians 6 says this. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. This is just a test for me. God, am I sowing seeds to my own flesh for my own destruction? And the sacrifice of Christ will pay for the penalty of those sins, but I'm going to still have to deal with the consequences. Or am I sowing in the Spirit? Because if we believe in Jesus, we upon that salvation, we receive the Holy Spirit and we have the Spirit of God inside of us constantly reminding us, no, this is the right way. This is the right way. You need to do this. Reminding us of the truth of the Scripture, constantly pointing us back to the Scriptures of God. And we want to sow to that. That's what we want because as children of the promise, you have a choice. But you have to deal with the consequences. Would you pray with me? God, this morning, we feel in our souls the tension of wanting to go our own way and choose sin and wanting to follow you. And God, with all of our souls, we want to follow you, but sometimes we're going to fall. And so this morning, we're so thankful for Jesus that when we do that, you are there. So we're thankful for Jesus, but Spirit of God, would you come and help us today and tomorrow and the next day choose to follow you so that we can live in the abundance that you have before us. Help us, Lord. We need your help. Amen.